Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of the co-hosts of the Undisclosed Podcast, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Rabia Chatri. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you, Colin?
Doing great. We're also joined by Jennifer Leahy. She is a research and investigative assistant who has been working with Rabia on various cases going all the way back to Jason Carroll. And so, Jennifer, as always, pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
Yeah, and so before we get into episode 3 of the Patricia Rohr series, I wanted to share an interesting story out of Alabama that bears upon a couple of the cases we've covered, including one recent one. These are cases out of Alabama. And so, Rabia, we obviously covered the case of Rocky Myers, and recently you spearheaded our coverage of Charles Sonny Burton, mm-hmm. both men on death row in Alabama. Both of them had their death sentences commuted. But both of them faced the prospect of being executed by nitrogen gas in Alabama. Well, last night, there was a third man, Jeffrey Lee, who is scheduled to be executed in Alabama by nitrogen gas. And he brought a constitutional challenge under the Eighth Amendment, claiming this was cruel and unusual punishment. And late last night, a district court judge in Alabama agreed. That judge found the use of nitrogen gas in execution, quote, likely leads to severe air hunger and corresponding emotional distress, anxiety, physiological stress, and physical discomfort for at least 1 to 3 minutes before there's asphyxiation of the person who's being executed. And the interesting wrinkle here, and this kind of, in some senses, gets to the disturbing nature of where we are with capital punishment in 2026, what Lee says is, I don't want to be given the nitrogen gas. I want to be killed by a firing squad, which harkens back to this method used centuries ago. And the judge ruled an execution pursuant to Lee's proposed firing squad alternative involving 4 30 caliber bullets fouled at his heart renders an inmate unconscious in 3 to 5 seconds. Due to the related phenomena of delayed brain processing and neural stunning, an inmate executed under Lee's firing squad alternative is rendered unconscious before his brain can process any pain. Thus, Lee's proposed alternative produces a quick and painless death. The state can readily obtain rifles, ammunition, and other materials necessary to carry out a firing squad execution. The state would be able to modify space to carry out executions by firing squad. The state is also able to source and train volunteers willing to carry out such an execution, in other words, to fatally shoot this individual in the heart. And so, I mean, I don't know what to take away from this, but Rabia, what are your thoughts on this ruling by the district court?
I mean, look, I understand like the kind of the intellectual processing here of like, you know, just kind of comparing the different methods of execution. It, however, still feels, I guess because it is a method that's gone back for so long, it feels kind of archaic and barbaric. And I also wonder, speaking from a just kind of a strategic standpoint, I wonder if Lee and his team were thinking, you know, they're proposing this alternate method of execution, thinking the court's probably not going to green light that either. Like, I wonder if it was not something that they really are seeking, but something that they are like, you know, putting in front of the court that like, kind of the fact that all these methods are barbaric in their own ways. And so, but I wonder also, has anybody been executed in Alabama by firing squad in recent years?
I don't think anyone in this country has been executed by firing squad in decades. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I wonder if they are also surprised by this ruling is what I'm trying to say.
And Jennifer, what are your thoughts on this ruling by the district court in Alabama?
Yeah. I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but I agree with Rabia in that all the different methods seem barbaric in their own ways. I mean, I've heard that hypoxia is just a terrible, terrible thing to experience, like air hunger. But the fact that we're discussing it at all, you know, and like firing squad, I don't know. I mean, both for the person that is being executed as well as what that does to the people that carry it out, you know, I mean, I think about that a lot. Like as well as us as a society, right?
Yeah. And if you were to follow kind of the reasoning of the court, well, I mean, a guillotine would work just as well. I mean, like, you don't know, that would be instant. I mean, if that's what we're kind of, if that's the only
Yeah.
kind of consideration here.
And I just read this recently. Do you know the last year the guillotine was used?
Are you
Or
kidding
have a
me?
guess?
Please. Where?
It was last used in 1977.
What?
Oh, yes. That I know.
Yeah.
I thought you said, I thought I misheard. I thought you said it was used last year. Yes. And
Oh,
wasn't
no.
it?
Yeah. It was last used in 1977. I mean, during our lifetimes, for at least the two of us, you know.
Was it France?
In France.
In
No, in
France,
France.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in our lifetimes. It's
Wow.
wild. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm sure that this will be appealed up to the appellate court and probably ultimately the Supreme Court. But yeah, it is.
But who's going to appeal this up? Who's going to appeal this up?
The state of Alabama will say this is our preferred execution method and we don't think it
Okay.
violates the Eighth Amendment.
And even hypoxia, I don't think it's been used yet, right? This is something
No.
that like it's a new method that they're
In
proposing.
Alabama. Yeah, I think maybe it was used once or twice, but it's Alabama is the only state where this has now been
Okay.
authorized. Yeah.
All right.
Right.
Well,
Well, pivoting from that into episode three of our Patricia Rohr series, this was the episode Leads to Nowhere. And that leads, I think, kind of has the double entendre there
yeah.
of the investigation by the officials not going anywhere, but also looking into these ex-partners of both Andy and Joe. And of course, one of them being Patricia Rohr, which is the focus of our series. But before we get to those other leads, of course, the prime suspect in the early days is Andy, Joe's husband. And we learned in this episode about these polygraph tests that Andy took. And focusing on the first one, he's asked three questions, and he's found to be deceptive on three of the four questions. Only one of those deals with withholding information related to the disappearance of his wife and child. And yet he explains his failed response by saying there was a vibrator that I put away before the authorities searched our home. And so, Rabia, what is your take on this explanation? And A, whether it relates at all to these questions, let alone the other two questions that he was showing to be deceptive on.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it feels almost like he was what prepared with a reason that he was going to fail, right? Like it's like in case he failed, he had a reason that he could bring up. He knew exactly why he was there. He knew that I'm assuming the kinds of questions they're going to be asking him, and he probably thought, I may or may not pass, and in case I don't pass, I got to come up with a reason. The actual reason, like that he told police that they had a sex toy in the bedroom next to the bed, and so he hid that, and that threw off everything. The questions, if we go back and look at those, like the four questions, let me see if I can scroll and find them. I don't think it explains.
Yeah. One, are you attempting to withhold information concerning the disappearance of your wife and
Yeah.
son? Two, do you know your wife and son are located? Three, are you attempting to mislead anyone regarding what happens to your wife and son? Four, did you personally have any involvement in the disappearance of your wife and
Right.
son?
I mean, the only, if it was that issue, that might be relevant to the first question. Are you attempting to withhold any information concerning the disappearance of your wife and son? But also, that would only be relevant if he is making that connection himself, that I am withholding information about the disappearance. Would the average person think that that is information concerning the disappearance? Like,
Right.
I would not consider moving a vibrator to be information concerning the disappearance. And I don't think the police bought him either because they brought him back the next day.
Yeah. And Jennifer, what was your take when you saw the results of this first failed polygraph, as well as the explanation that was given by Andy?
Yeah, so similarly, I guess for question three, which is the one maybe I had a different read on it when I was looking at the report. I thought it was just question three that he had failed, but the attempting to withhold information. I mean, I guess if he was like the kind of person that was like perseverating over, like, oh, I moved this one thing before the search, and so then that's, but I don't know. It seems, I don't know enough about polygraphs, but it seems a little bit of a stretch.
Jennifer, that happens a second time around where he's deceptive on
Yeah,
three.
the second
The
time.
first time around, he's deceptive on three of them.
Oh, okay. I'll
Yeah,
have to go back
yeah.
and look through the reports. Okay. Yeah, I mean that question just
I mean, the issue of a vibrator
Yeah.
related to, do you know where your wife and son are located? It has
Right.
no connection to that.
Right. That wouldn't be any.
Look, and you got, and we put photographs of the home on social media, and those were pictures taken 2 days after her disappearance. She, I mean, Joe really was like in an immaculate housekeeper. Like her home
Right.
is super clean. It's everything is in its place. It's amazing. I think she's like, that's, and her car seems like that too. So the question of whether she would herself have left that out, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. And we're going to get into this in another episode, and that is, or maybe we actually already talked about it. The fact that I'm just going to go ahead and say it, whether or not we talked about it, I can remember, is that there were numerous reports that at that point, by that point, Andy was actually sleeping in a different bedroom.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that
So,
was this episode.
which frustrate
Yeah, for so whatever that's worth.
Yeah, wait, Jen, I think you just mentioned it frustrates you. What's the frustration there?
Oh no, just related to that, like I wish there were more reports from the search of the house, and because they had another unit upstairs, and Andy, if I recall correctly, was denying sleeping in separate rooms, but like did they notice any, like was there like a bed or a mattress set up upstairs? Like there's that lack of information that's at least in the
Yeah.
reports that we have access to is frustrating.
And in terms of the reports we have access to, Rabia, you mentioned the two polygraphs. And then, as we noted in the episode, the FBI was supposed to do sort of a third polygraph test, and there's no record of what actually happened there. I'll start with you, Rabia. Do you think that he actually was given a polygraph by the FBI and it's missing from the records, or do you think that never actually happened?
No, I do think it was administered. They were given their report, and they were, I think they had scheduled it. And then we just don't have a copy of like, the results of it. And I think that's something in the past that has been requested and it's never been turned over.
Yeah, it's part of my FOIA request that I
Well, there
submitted.
you go.
Got it. And so when, Jen, did you submit that FOIA request?
Oh, a while ago now, like I don't know, a couple months. I had to look at the date, I think a couple months. Yeah, it's in the system.
And I'm pretty sure Tammy as well, Tammy Mall, who we've mentioned her before, who was an advocate for Patricia, has also submitted one before about this, not gotten anything back.
Yes.
Yeah. And if we're sticking with Andy now as the initial suspect in the early days of the investigation, we have a comment by Shannon French, a listener. I'm really suspicious of the husband, and it's really disappointing they didn't do more to check out his parents' stories and his alibi too. Okay, and so if we go back to his alibi, he says he was working with his dad on a home that was owned by Kathy and Tom Holschwander. The site was about 20 minutes away from the home. Right, that's the general alibi that he has, Rabia.
Yeah, that is his alibi. Now, the Holschwanders were not home all day.
Right.
Tom went to work, Kathy was out all day. Only Tom was home, I think, in the morning when Andy arrived, I believe. Or actually they might have left. But what we know for sure is this. When Tom got home that afternoon, he says that him and Andy did some plumbing work on the house. That was going to be like after 3:30 p.m. Okay, he's saying that he was definitely there. And his father, Andy's father, says that when I left the site, which was between 2:30 and 3, he was there. Like Andy was still there. Of course, that's Andy's dad, so take that with a grain of
Right.
salt. Now, the Holschwanders have two kids, and they're also asked about him being there. It's interesting because if you look at like what they say, they don't necessarily say that I saw him, but they say that they could hear him and their father working on the house together, if I'm not misremembering, and Jennifer, correct me if I am. I don't think they actually said that we like actually saw him. But as far as the rest of the day is gone goes, nobody else is home other than Andy and his dad, Andy Senior.
And even to your point, Robert, to the extent the dad is an alibi, that does end this. I mean, we're not sure exactly when Joe and Alex were abducted, and
Right.
so 2:33, even according to the father's story, he's not with his son, right?
Right, he leaves at that point. Yeah, he leaves at that
Jen, what's
point.
your take on this alibi that Andy has? Robbie has sort of laid out how it's a lot weaker than it might appear on paper. What was your take as you read through all the papers regarding his alibi?
Yeah, the first thing was that I was frustrated that the lack of specificity in terms of the time, you know, his times vary a little bit in terms of what time he left the house, whether he stopped and got coffee, what time, you know, what time he arrived at the house. His dad doesn't leave to join him at the site until he says like 9:30. So there could be even a potential couple hours at the beginning, right, of the morning where
Sure.
he's alone. The host wanders. I think there's no timestamp on when Tom leaves for work. His wife, Kathy, I think says that she saw them at some point in the morning, but can't be specific. And then the kids like say that they were there, but even that is sort of, it must, I wonder if they're confusing dates because they were there all the time, the two of them, you know, for like
Right.
weeks, because they say they saw his dad that afternoon, which we know couldn't be true because his dad left before they got home from school.
And the other thing is I think, you know, they've been working on that site for a while. They've been working on the site for a while. They're there like day after day. You know, there's also a possibility that maybe the kids are getting a little confused. You know, by the time they're interviewed,
Exactly.
I think it's like a week or so has gone by. They might be mixing up days. The most reliable alibi Andy has in all this is his father. And I think it's fair to question how reliable that is as well.
To Jen's point about the early hours of the morning, to reiterate to our listeners, right, the only witness who claims to have spoken to Joe at all that day is Andy's mother, who says, I called at 1:15, right? Beyond that, we have no idea if she's not correct when Joe and Alex disappeared, right?
Exactly.
And that ties into a comment which had a lot of resonance for me, at least the type of person I am. This is by Claire Goodwin Gage. I too have so many questions about the 1:15 p.m. phone call. Mostly I doubt that it took place, but I also want to know if these impromptu day of shopping trips were commonplace for Andy's mom and Joe. Andy's parents' behavior screams they're covering for their son. There's another comment about, I think she calls back at 4 p.m., which is like 2 hours and 45 minutes later. Like, why would you not be concerned about your daughter-in-law and grandson in that intervening period of time? And so, you know, Jennifer, what's your take on Andy's mom saying, I called at 1:15. Joe says she's about to leave to meet up with me, and it's not until 4 that she says she calls back.
Yeah, I mean, the time does change a little bit. Like, I think at a certain point she says 3, but regardless,
Still a
that stood
decent
out
effort,
to
though.
me. Yeah, no, that stood out to me immediately, that, and I think I remember reading another listener saying, wouldn't she be concerned? And those two things, that is what entered my mind, was like, she was, at least from the other interviews I've read, she was known to be sort of a concerned grandmother. And, you know, the Holzwanders were longtime friends of their sons. Like, I'm sure they had a landline, you know, like, what, how come she didn't reach out? Like, you know, or, you know, after her husband got home, like, have somebody go over there and look for that. You know, there's other ways, or try reaching Andy somehow. That struck me as odd. It struck me as a little odd, maybe, but I don't know their family dynamics, that Joe would, on a tight timeline, because she was supposed to have to get back, you know, by like for dinner or other things, drive like at least 20 minutes each way when she had like a shopping mall that was, and in some accounts, she's going to the shopping mall that's like right near her house in Catasauqua. Anyways, but you know, but there could be other dynamics at play. Maybe, you know, she's trying to connect with her, who knows, you know. Yeah, both things struck me as unusual.
And Rabia, which you know, assume that your child has a spouse and you have a grandchild and you make a call at 1:15 p.m. and they say, I'm just about to leave. I'll meet up with you. Waiting until whether it's 4 or 3 p.m. to follow up on that. What's your take on that story by Andy's mother?
Well, look, let me start off by saying right now, as of today, I do have a grandchild.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. My first
I didn't want to
grandchild
reveal it, but yeah, I was gonna almost mix that into the
was.
question.
No, I saw what you were putting down, Colin. I picked it up. Yeah, I had a grandson a week ago, and so I'm like on cloud nine, and I'm waiting for my daughter to file a restraining order against me at some point, because I want like so much access to this baby and I want to raise it. So, and likewise, I have heard, there are numerous reports. I think two or three different people said that a point of contention, like her mother-in-law did make her crazy, that Joe's mother-in-law was really controlling about the baby. Now think about this. This is, as far as we know, I think her only grandchild, right? And all these years, Andy did not have a child, maybe could not have a child, and so first grandbaby. And so this was an issue between her and her mother-in-law, that her mother-in-law was too controlling about the baby. But I'll say this, forget being concerned. I mean, it wouldn't even make sense to be concerned until maybe Andy calls and says, my wife and child aren't home. I imagine, especially then, before you had cell phones, but even now, if you're telling me I'll be ready, I'll be there in 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and I have got my coat and shoes on, I'm going to call you because I'm annoyed.
Well, there's that too, yeah.
Right. Have you left the house yet? Like, I would want to know. Her account that she basically put on her shoes and her coat and then stood at the window till her husband came home. That's what she said she did. That's an hour and a half of standing at the window. That makes no sense to me. Why aren't you calling and being like, listen, it's been like 30 minutes. Have you left the house? Right? Like, I find that odd. And then when her husband gets home and then she eventually does call because he's like, why don't you give her a call? Then she's like, all right, I guess I'll take off my shoes and my coat. None of that adds up to me. Something is off about it. And yes, that is the only corroboration. The only reason we know that Joe is even alive on that day mm-hmm. is because of this phone call, whether or not it took place.
And Rabia, you mentioned in that answer, this being the grandmother's only grandchild, not even being sure whether her son could have a child. And of course, this was a topic that came up in the episode about both Patricia and another former partner of Andy's having children with other men, but Patricia not using birth control during a fairly long relationship with Andy and never becoming pregnant, leading to the question of, is Alex the biological son of Andy? I mean, Rabia, how much of a question is that to you, or is that just sort of this interesting theory in the files?
I think it is a fair question to ask because people who knew him all those years ago were wondering about it themselves. And, you know, it's not just Patricia's mother, Mrs. Chambers, who says, we were like, oh, how'd he have a baby? But I think a couple other people also said that they weren't sure because he had a number of long-term girlfriends, live-in girlfriends, and none of them ever had a child by him, never used birth control, but went on to have children with other partners. I think it's a fair question. And I wonder if he wondered about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I will say that's not to say that it's impossible that he just didn't have a baby and then he did. They ended up having that happens too. I've seen that happen. It is possible, but I don't think it's an unfair question to ask given the circumstances.
Yeah. And Jen, what about your take in reading through this in the files? Loose end or something that has some serious legs?
Yeah, no, I'd be curious. I agree with Rabia. And in fact, something you said when we were down in Pennsylvania earlier, saying that regardless of whether, you know, Alex is his biological child or not, if there for whatever reason was some reason for him to doubt that, could that doubt alone or the circumstances that created that doubt, if that, you know, was that ever a point of question? Because that in and of itself could be relevant.
Yeah. And did that have something to do with him sleeping apart? I mean, like, we don't know because, see, I haven't seen any report in which we know that he was asked whether or not he's sleeping apart. All we know is he was asked, how's your relationship? And he kept saying it's great. So mm-hmm. he might have never even been asked the question directly.
Yeah. Sticking with Andy for another comment by a listener, we have Kiana Florence. This goes back to episode 2. She says, what made my suspicion about Andy's possible anger over Joe's visit with her male coworker, that's the one from Six Flags, is that he lied to him when he called days later and said the car was left there. Did he hire a PI like he suggested he intended? And so going back to the episode 2 script, Andy told Hale, the former coworker, that Joe and Alex were taken from the house, and he knew that because the car was still at the house. He also said, I'm trying to find a private investigator. I know you're a cop now, the coworker, so I thought maybe you would know someone I could hire. Jennifer, when he says the car is at the house, and it's close by, but it's, you know, obviously at McCarty's Pub, do you find that to be a meaningful discrepancy, or that's kind of the same thing?
I feel like it'd be kind of the same thing. I mean, it's like, you know, a number of yards away. So I didn't personally register that.
Yeah. And also I'll say this. I mean, again, we don't know exactly how Andy put it, but this is how Hale told the police that he put it, right? So maybe Andy said it was close to the house. It was around the corner from the house. And Hale just reported it to the police as it was at the house. But the gist of it being what Andy's interpretation of where the car was, what that meant for Joe and Alex.
Yeah, and then Robbie, in terms of the PI comment, do we know whether Andy or the family ever did hire
No.
a private investigator?
No, they did not.
Okay. In terms of the phone call, which the prosecution claims is the instigating event where Patty wins this national championship and is calling around to people, including Andy, and she reaches Joe and Joe says never to call here again. I want to just highlight for listeners because I wasn't 100% sure myself before going back. Patricia had already called and knew A, that Andy was married to Joe, and B, that she was pregnant in a prior phone call, right? This is not new news in
Right.
either the marriage or the child front, right?
Exactly correct. Yep. She already knew all this.
Yeah. And then in terms of this national championship, is there any more detail or context on that? Because you sort of, laid out her winning this national championship. What exactly went into that in terms of this competition?
I mean, we're going to get into that as we explore kind of what Patty's life was looking like at the time and in the weeks and days and leading up to all of this.
Okay.
But look, Patty kept horses. She rode horses. She was competing in this championship. It was not easy for her to get to it. We're going to talk about that too, because it was out in Oklahoma. She had to figure out how to get to Oklahoma. She did not have the money to get to Oklahoma. And then, she ends up placing in this, and it was a big deal. And she already was in the habit of keeping in touch with, men from her past who she was friends with. And Andy was only one of them. He wasn't the only ex-boyfriend that she reached out to. So, but the point being, not so much that, I mean, the state's theory is not that she got angry that he was married and had a baby, but that she got angry that Joe yelled at her and hung up.
Right. Turning from the phone call to, as an evidence professor, one of the two most disturbing things in this case, and it's related to the second, which is the hair, and we'll get to that in a later episode. But as you noted in this episode, Jen and Rabia, when the car is searched, when Joe's car at McCarty's pub is brought in and searched, they find this clump of blonde hair in the driver's side. And it's noted in the files, it is positive for the presence of blood, which should allow us to at least get a blood type, if not a DNA profile. But then later we have Dr. Jensen, who again we note will be critical later in this case. And he, on the stand at trial, says, "I couldn't verify that this was blood, despite the obvious early reference in the files saying there's the presence of blood." Jennifer, what was your take when you saw this first in the files, this transformation from it's positive for blood to I can't say it was blood?
So was it the hair or was it the seat back that they were swabbing in this case? Or was
I
it,
think it was the seat back. I think in
yeah,
the
seat
area
back.
of the clump of
Right,
hair.
right. It
Yeah.
initially turned. Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I would love for a forensic scientist to weigh in on, or maybe they have on where the confusion might lie, how you could get one thing and then another, and then what his testimony might mean, which, as you heard in the episode, it was confusing to me what that meant, what we were supposed to take away from it, if anything.
And Rabia, what is your take on this? Overconfidence in the first statement, lack of preservation, or what's your
Yeah.
take on how this transformed from positive presence to I'm not sure?
Here's the thing. The positive presence was not just indicated by one test. It was then confirmed by a second on-site test. To me, and the way we tied it into the episode also was the fact that maybe it was an issue of how they were collecting the evidence. They're using post-it notes, okay, to collect evidence. I mean, Jen and I saw those post-it notes in the evidence files, and they were not using standard methods. They also removed the car seat and transported it. Later, we're going to get into how a lot of the evidence ended up contaminated, including some of that hair ends up getting contaminated by different people handling the evidence. So could they have just accidentally wiped the seat, wiped that little speck of blood off the seat? I don't know. And Jensen's answers are infuriating. I mean, we read, or the quote from the trial of what he said, which is like, what does that even mean? Like, explain that. And he doesn't go on to explain it either, of like, what does it mean that I couldn't verify the presence of it, but it was like, explain that. What does that mean? Does that mean either way? But like I said, the bottom line is though, they just didn't get a blood sample out of it. They didn't get anything out of it. So the fact that it was indicated by two different tests means somebody mishandled that evidence then and ruined it, basically. I think that's what happened.
And Robbie, you mentioned this fairly odd method of taking Post-it notes and using that to grab the evidence and fold it up. Do you know what happened after they had those Post-it notes? Were they put in sort of zip bags? Or do you know what happened to those Post-it notes after the evidence was collected?
They would then fold them in half and put them in envelopes, just like white envelopes is what I think.
Just like a regular, not a hermetically sealed, just like a white envelope.
No.
Yeah.
And look, I don't know. I'm not a forensic expert, but I wonder about, like, you know, I mean, if I see these hairs and that hair has a little blood on it and I take a sticky note and I slap it on the hair, is that sticky note going to, like, you know, do something to the blood underneath it? Is it going to, like, mess the blood, or is the adhesive on the sticky note going to alter results later? You know, I don't know, but I do know that this was it. They called it an unorthodox method of evidence collection. Yeah, it just seemed they were sloppy. They continue to be sloppy once they had the evidence in their possession.
Yeah, and Jen, as I noted in the intro again for you, you are, you know, investigator. And when I look at a typical case with a crime scene investigator, they will have the hermetically sealed bags and they will store this evidence and refrigerate where necessary. Jen, what was your take when you saw what Robbie just described in terms of this method of using Post-it notes to collect and kind of store the evidence?
Yeah. So, I mean, to be clear, my background's more in research, so, but I had not come across it before. I'd be really interested to hear if anybody out there has, you know. It seems when I think about Post-it notes, I mean, I think about all the other stuff that gets stuck to them, you know, like, unless these were like some sort of like special sealed Post-it, you know, I mean, like, what other material? I mean, is it just an open sticky surface, like, that just, and then you're going to peel them off? I don't know. It doesn't seem like the, I'm curious why that was used and if they used this in all their cases, you know, if like how long this was done for, at what point, you know, what do they do now?
I mean, look, anybody who's had a sticky pad lying around can pick it up and be like, why is the back got all kinds of random stuff stuck to it? Like, sticky pads will just pick up little fibers and dust particles and all kinds of things that aren't necessarily relevant to the evidence you're trying to collect.
Right, they're gross. I mean, just like you have one in a bag of any kind, and if there's like a molecule that can like latch onto it, will.
Yeah.
Yeah. My final point will help us seg into episode 4, and that is we close episode 3 by explaining how about 4 months after Joe and Alex disappeared, they are found by Joseph Vasquez while he is plowing. And it's sort of right there in his line of sight. And again, Robbie, we'll discuss a lot of details next episode. But in terms of Mr. Vasquez, who I'm not sure that we discuss again in later episodes, was this the first time, do we know, that he had plowed or worked in that area in the intervening 4 months? Or what do we know about Joseph Vasquez, who found the bodies?
That is a great question. And honestly, I believe so, because this is like, you know, winter. It was a long winter, longer than we initially realized, and I actually get into that in episode 4. And when he's saying he's plowing, I mean, you know, that's kind of the first thing farmers do, like, as they're you know, approaching a new season, is you plow the field and you get it ready to start, like, actually planting your seed or planting whatever it is you're planting. Plowing is kind of the first thing. But I will go back and check out his trial testimony to see if there's more information about whether he had been out there. It doesn't seem like he had been out there earlier than that. And this is April in Pennsylvania. Right. And that makes sense to me. I can't imagine plowing your field like earlier than that, given just, you know, the climate and the area and just like planting season and all that.
Yeah. And Jen, have you been out in the area where they were found and sort of walked and gotten a sense of the lay of the land there?
Unfortunately, I have not had that chance yet. I would love to. I drove through, you know, the general area, but my last visit, I didn't have the time. I think Rabia and Sarah were out there, right? You actually went to the site. In case we want to note for listeners, the name of the man who found the body was actually Paul Kowalczyk.
Oh, sorry. I mixed the trooper's name up with the...
Yeah, I
Or
can't
something.
remember if the other one was on scene soon after, but the farmer was Paul Kowalczyk. I hope I'm pronouncing that
Okay,
correctly.
got
Thanks
it.
for catching that.
Thank you.
That's right. Vasquez was a trooper. Yeah, I was out there with Sarah, and we ended up we wanted to get to the crime scene from the same direction that Kowalczyk found the body, so we wanted to go to the field. And this field is behind a house. We knocked, and there was a lot of snow on the ground when we went out there, and we just couldn't get a response. So we're like, you know what? We'll apologize later. We parked, and we just started stomping back into the field. And when we were there, even though, I mean, this is decades later, like we could kind of still identify the clearing, between these three big trees, which had been identified in photographs, and we could see the spot. We could see it from the field, that we were in. And yeah, I, you know, these are questions that just I keep going over and over, is how could they have been out there that long and nobody saw them, whether it was from the field. Let's say the farmers has not gone back, or nobody's gone back there in the field. But again, there's a trail running not far from them. And yeah, we will get deeper into that question, these questions in episode four.
Yeah. And so, Robbie, that leads into then our teaser for episode four. And so, what should listeners expect in our next episode?
Episode four is all about the crime scene and the autopsies. And yeah, it's all real tragic. It's not easy to digest. And but we're going to get into kind of the evidence found at the scene, what the medical examiner found in terms of what caused the deaths of Joanne and Alex, and the injuries that were suffered by Joanne. And I don't know how we can kind of understand what was going on there.
Yeah. And Robbie, listeners might be curious, have you had the chance recently to speak to Patty, and how is she doing? Has she had a chance to listen to any of our coverage so far?
I have not spoken to Patty since the season began. So, and I doubt if she has the ability, but I'll message Tammy to see if she's able to. I'm traveling for a different case this week, so juggling a lot of things along with the grandbaby. But hopefully, I can get in touch with Patty next week.
All right. Well, Jen and Rabia, thanks so much for joining me today on the Undisclosed Addendum. And listeners, we will see you back next Monday for episode four of Undisclosed, the State versus Patricia Rohr.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you, Jen.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
If you want even more Undisclosed content, remember you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer three quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia squared 2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.